stay tuned to PRN, your source for the best in progressive radio.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios, New York City. And I'd like to welcome you from all over the world, syndicated stations and people listening over the telephone, watching over your computer. We're here to empower people. We divide the program into sections. For example, our large sections on health, healing, and reversing the aging process naturally. And today we're going to talk specifically about one nutrient only, cancer and vitamin C, and also how the main medical community could learn a lesson from what I'm going to share. Many of you already have. So I'm going to talk about the latest studies on chemotherapy for cancer, specifically breast cancer, but also how do we rebuild the mitochondria, the energy factories, and what does that mean when we have breast cancer? So that's going to be a major discussion. Also today, we do a segment called Public Health Science. And one of the most really challenging issues is Wi-Fi and wireless communication. Many of you have smart meters. Many of you probably don't even know it. I came home, found out that when I was away on the road for 3 months, they had installed a smart meter. I immediately had them take it out, you know, with threat of lawsuit if they didn't. They took it out. The man didn't understand why. So I spent about 20 minutes explaining why smart meters are dangerous to your health and shouldn't be used anywhere. But how do you tell someone, especially a young person, their cell phones, their Wi-Fi places, that those are dangerous also? Really dangerous. So today our classroom on the air will be about the dangers of a wireless society and some of the things they're doing in California that is leading the way to put 50,000 wireless towers around the state using all kinds of buildings. But in Michigan, AT&T wants it by law that they can put it on your house. And if you don't allow it, you don't get phone service. So that's going to be our discussion. Then a brief commentary on Thinking Dangerously, the Role of Higher Education in Authoritarian Times, Professor Henry Giroux. I'm going to play you a short piece on, it's only about 3 minutes, of a person who is a parody example of what is happening to an awful lot of young people. And the reason I'm doing this is because on July 4th, I was doing my broadcast, and afterwards, someone sent me an email. And it was this fella out on a beach, affluent neighborhood, and he was asking people about celebrating the 4th of July, where America became free from China. And the founding fathers of America, the people signed the Declaration of Independence, like Jesse Ventura and John Wilkes Booth. Now, I would have thought people had just broken out laughing. It's funny. They took it seriously. And he couldn't get a single person in the 4.5 minutes I watched to tell us what we were fighting for, who we were fighting against, who any of our founding fathers were. Some said Kennedy. Some said Lincoln. We're talking about the Revolutionary War. Now, if it had been one person who had never been to school, but we're talking about college graduates, we're talking about people at Ivy League schools who didn't know this. So now I decided to play you a little clip of what it means to be some of these people. And these are the people, these are the snowflakes. These are the people who cannot take any contradictions to their conditioning. What happens in the real world, which is a complete contradiction, everything that we've been taught by snowflake-creating parents. So I think you'll find it interesting. And then I'm going to have a short talk back. Then I'm going to play you a segment with Robert Kennedy Jr. today, who has done so much good for environmental, let's say, environmental standards. He has been there pro bono to help with the river project, to help people get rid of nuclear power, close down Indian Point. He's a major voice, a voice I respect. And the only place he could find, and he says it, the only place he could find, except for this program, is Tucker Carlson over at Fox. Wow. So we're bringing one of our scholars in residence, one of the heavy thinkers that's a part of Progressive Radio Network, on the program today to talk about the betrayal of the liberal community, the destruction of the liberal community for liberal ideals. Chris Hedges talks about this, but we're going to bring you more of these betrayals and be very specific about it. We're also going to present later today on our website a list of the organizations that you can go to that we have selected that we believe represent the truth in all areas, like Truthdig or Consortium News. But we have a list of dozens and dozens. So the idea that you only have CNN or Fox or MSNBC or NBC is not true. You can have places other than NPR or PBS to go to for quality, insightful, original, outstanding reporting. We're going to provide that list as a public service to you today. It'll be posted probably within an hour on PRN.FM, meaning ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. So let's begin. We have a lot to share. I'm not sure we can get it all in, but we'll try. But I'm selecting one topic to begin our program. Oh, by the way, in the second part of our program, Dr. Ramzi Baroud, one of the most outstanding journalists, scholars on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, will be here to talk about the Israeli versus Palestinian narrative of history and an update on life and conditions in Gaza. This is interesting. It says, and this is from Vox, in 1 year, drug overdoses killed more Americans than the entire Vietnam War did. And they just took 1 year. These are drug overdoses. Now, how many? Well, we knew that 58,000 died in the Vietnam War in the 10 years that America was participating. But we're looking here at over 65,000 deaths in 1 year. And the largest group of those, opiates, like OxyContin, those types. Why? So when we talk about health care, whether it's Obamacare or some new version of a health care, none of these deal with what's wrong with our medical paradigm. Meaning, let's say that everyone in this audience was able, with universal health care, maybe through Medicare, that no matter what medical condition you had, A, you didn't have copays, B, you couldn't go bankrupt, C, no matter how extensive the operation, any and every center had to welcome you in and operate on you. Now, compare that to Michael Moore's movie, which I'm glad that you saw, if you did, Sicko, where it showed an example of in Canada someone had some fingers cut, was able to go into a hospital, no charge, no paperwork, nothing, got them all reattached. Because one of the things that American medicine does, and I really commend it for it, we had the best emergency medicine in the world, hands down. That means if you get an eye punctured, you get a tooth knocked out, you have to have resuscitation from a stroke or a heart attack. If you have an amputation needed on a gangrene leg, we're good at rescuing people with emergency medicine. That's good. That represents maybe 10 to 12% of all medicine. That means 88 to 90% of medicine fails miserably. And with chronic care, that includes cancer, heart disease, mental conditions, inflammatory conditions like arthritis, etc. So let's just say you got all the bills paid for. But what if you were given, for example, only one treatment? You were given a standard treatment. You had pain, you were given opiates. Now, you're going to have problems, first of all, because all the scientific literature, I mean all of it shows that opiates do not have any benefit long term, and yet they're meant to be taken for the rest of your life. Because when people are in chronic pain, they're almost always in chronic pain forever. Because we do not deal with the underlying cause, we deal with the symptoms. So, how many people right now, as I'm speaking, in the United States have chronic pain and are under medical supervision? 100 million. In fact, more Americans are seeking medical care for pain than any other condition. So, the treatment we're giving these people doesn't work. It kills them. 65,000 last year. You would think that if you killed more people in 1 year or more people died in 1 year than all of 10 years in Vietnam in heavy conflict, maybe we should examine the paradigm. What are we doing wrong? Are there natural non-toxic approaches? Yes, there are. Can we turn off pain, any kind of pain, pancreatic cancer pain, by going in from a local acidosis to local alkalosis and get the bodies to shift pain reception? Yes, we can. Do we want to do that? We don't want to do anything except what the people who are making money, the pharmaceutical companies, is dictating. The pharmaceutical companies controls everything in medicine. When I say everything, I mean everything. So even if you got free care, you're not getting quality care. You're not getting life-saving care. You're not getting enhancement of life care. That should concern us. You would think that there'd be meetings about this. There are none. So in my world, we should create a brand new medical paradigm, one that first asks, do you have hard, independent scientific proof that the treatment you're suggesting actually benefits people, greater benefit than risk? And if you can't prove that by independent, not your own science, because that's fraudulent, then it shouldn't be used. If we did that, 90% of all medicines given would not be allowed. At least half of all medical procedures like statin drugs would not be allowed. None of your psychiatric drugs would be allowed. You wouldn't have any selective serotonin reuptake. You wouldn't have Paxil, Prozac, Zoloft, Effexor, because none of them work. There's never been a single person, not one person in the history of the United States cured by these stupid medications. But boy, do they make people money, starting with the pharmaceutical industry. So wouldn't you look at what actually causes it? Wouldn't you bring in the best and brightest minds to ask, why are we depressed? Why are we anxious? Why do we have altered perceptions? Shouldn't we have non-natural, non-toxic approaches to prevent these in the first place and to help deal with them naturally in the second? The answer is yes. So we need to go across the board, and that's what I'm doing now. I'm working with over 100 scientists, ethicists, physicians, specialists, to look for the best way of helping people prevent and then treat medical conditions. When this is complete as a white paper, I will present it to every member of Congress. I will present it to every scientific body in the United States. I will present this to every scientist in the United States. I will present this to more than 900,000 physicians. It'll be made available to them. So about 4 million people will read or have available to read this complete radical change in our healthcare system that will A, save lives, B, prevent disease, C, will treat people using only those protocols that are known to benefit people. I'm working on it now. I've been working on it for 2 years. We're probably 6 months away from it. Now, let me tell you why this is important, because this is the latest, and this is just going to make no news anywhere, but this is from Albert Einstein College of Medicine, Yeshiva University. Quote, scientists warn chemotherapy could spread cancer, trigger more aggressive tumors. Quote, a new study shows chemotherapy can cause malignant cancer cells to spread throughout the body, increasing the risk of fatality, that means death, from the disease. Chemotherapy can increase aggressively in aggressivity in cancer, causing malignant cells to migrate and triggering more dangerous tumors, thereby increasing the disease's fatality And patients with breast cancer who opt for chemotherapy as treatment actually face a risk of metastasis, according to a new study in Science Reports. Quote, this is from the actual Science Reports. The blood vessels of patients receiving chemotherapy drugs have been more entry points through which cancer cells can get into the blood flow and disperse throughout the body. Scientists report today in Science Translational Medicine, in mice with breast cancer, chemotherapy shrinks the primary tumor but boosts the number of cancer cells in the lungs and circulating in the body, end quote. Now, almost anybody who gets chemotherapy and radiation will see for a period of time tumors shrinking, sometimes completely. But that means that the body's immune system has created an enormous challenge for itself. So in the moment, for a month or a year, a person thinks, okay, I'm cancer-free. And then the cancer comes back, but it comes back and now you have no immune system. And the person dies quickly. That is the part of the cancer story you haven't heard. Now, we've posted articles. I played you videos about how ineffective cancer therapy is. And why is this important to me? Because in 1972, I was approached by a multi-award-winning journalist, highly respected. His name's Pat McGrady Jr. He was the Moscow bureau chief for Newsweek. And he said, there's a major story needs to be told, but no one I know is going to tell it. Because when you tell this story, you're going to have a ton of bricks fall on your head. I said, what's the story? He said that there's natural treatments that can reverse cancer, and it's been proven. And what people are using, the people giving it know that it causes cancer and doesn't work. And I said, what's your proof? He said, I've got one of the top people in the entire cancer world, one of the most respected people in the entire world of cancer, that will talk with you. I said, good. So I said, let me talk with this gentleman. So a couple days later, I met with him. His name was Pat McGrady Sr. He was the father of Pat McGrady. Who was he? He was one of the most recognized, respected names in the entire world of cancer. He was the head of public relations at the American Cancer Society for more than 25 years. So if anyone wanted to know anything about cancer, they went to him. And he told me that we've been living a lie. And he's ashamed of himself for being a part of it, but he needed to get this off his chest, and would I do the story. But he warned me. He said, you're going to have the pharmaceutical industry, the news media, no one's going to touch this. So I don't know where you're going to put it. You can put it on your radio show, but I don't know anywhere else they're going to do it. So I spent over a year traveling the world, interviewing people that he had suggested I interview, seeing their therapy, reviewing their patient records, and then looking at how corrupt the cancer establishment was. And I wrote a story. And I took it to all the liberal publications. Mother Jones, Atlantic Monthly, Ramparts, East Village Other, Ms. Magazine. Nobody would touch it. Not because there was a single thing in there that was not accurate. Every single thing was vetted by an independent oncologist who was hired. And a team of lawyers, completely accurate. But it was touching a sacred cow. You couldn't do it. In America, there's certain things you cannot touch. I don't care who you are. If you touch it, they will push you into the next century. That's how much power they have. And this is not the deep state I'm talking about. These are simply radicalized liberals and radicalized conservatives who refuse to acknowledge that what information you're sharing is true. And so they're living in some kind of cognitive disconnect. They can't accept this truth. So a little tiny publication on the East Side published it. And it won the Audi Award, Best Investigative Journalism. And it took a year, but a person approached me one day. He was well known, and he had been on NBC. And he said, this needs to get to a bigger audience. And I said, I've tried every place. Nobody will touch it. He said, I know someone who will, and that someone finally published it. Against the advice of his lawyer, Roy Grutman, head of his advertising, you'll lose all the advertising in here. And he had a very quiet voice, and he turns to me after everyone in his company said, no, don't touch it. And he said, do you really believe we can save some lives? I said, sir, if we publish this, we will save lives, because people who need cancer treatment will at least know that there's some legitimate non-toxic therapies that I've individually and proven work on hundreds, 500 with one doctor, 15,000 with another doctor. So these are not people working out of their garage someplace. These are legitimate medical doctors with legitimate treatments. It's just that the American Cancer Establishment will not touch this because you can't patent it. Nobody can profit from it. So he published it. And sure enough, people responded. Oh, I got attacked. You bet I got attacked. Had chairman of the board of the American Medical Association attack me. And a whole lot of people in the media wouldn't touch it. But 60 Minutes and Raul Rivera won two Emmys for this story on Dr. Stanislav Brzezinski. And before that, 60 Minutes, Don Hewlett took one of my stories and did a story on it for 60 Minutes on Dr. Lawrence Burton. So it opened up. And then Gabe Pressman, who just died last week or two, he did a 10-part series, and then a whole lot of other people began to get involved in it. So if you think you've been told the truth about cancer, you have not. You've been lied to by everyone at all stages. Do we need a new approach to cancer? You bet we do. Here's just a few studies I want to share with you, and I'm only talking about one today. This is the latest. This is the University of Salford, which is in the United Kingdom, where they have universal health care. So nobody can really profit off the therapy. Therefore, there's no reason for someone to deny therapy. Quote, increasingly, researchers are discovering the role played by cancer stem cells in the growth and spread of disease. In a groundbreaking new research, vitamin C showed its ability to target cancer stem cells and stop their growth, preventing the reoccurrence of tumors. Although mainstream medicine has been slow to accept the cancer-fighting properties of vitamin C, the exciting results of the study could help change that. It's official, vitamin C interferes with cancer stem cell metabolism. In a newly published study conducted at the University of Salford in Manchester, vitamin C demonstrated its power to stop tumors in their tracks by interfering with cancer stem cell metabolism, suppressing their ability to process energy for survival and growth. Cancer stem cells are responsible for triggering tumor reoccurrence and promoting their growth and metastasis. Researchers believe that cancer stem cells give cancer its ability to resist chemotherapy and radiation, the reason for treatment failure in advanced cancer patients. Then it goes on from that. How many other studies do we have showing that natural nutrients like vitamin C, including intravenous vitamin C and other nutrients, can help with cancer, either prevention or treatment? Hundreds. Why don't we know about this? They're not patentable, they're not profitable, and no one's going to interfere in a $300 billion a year profit-making industry. But we're going to keep sharing this information on this program. That's what we do. And if we have to get in the face of these people, so be it. But at least you, the public, will know that there are other ways of approaching condition. And because I believe in freedom of choice, ultimately what you choose is up to you, and I will support you in that. I don't tell people not to take a drug. I just tell them better understand the drug and whether there's good science or corporate science. And by the way, there's another one right here, and I want to thank Sarah G. from GreenMed Info on this. And it says, reverse cancer with targeted mitochondrial restoration. And it goes into the mitochondria, the conductor of physiological orchestra in your body. And why do cancer patients have such fatigue? Why does anyone sick? It's mitochondria. So it shows about how the mitochondria can help reverse cancers. That's just another study. Will it be published anywhere? Absolutely not. Will it get by their peer review system? Absolutely not. But is it true? Yes. Do we publish it on our site? Yes. Every day, things like this that can make a difference. And oh, and by the way, if you're one of those people that is a ramrod, rigid, ultra true believer in orthodoxy, which is fine, that's your business. Here's the latest. And this is from Nationwide Children's Hospital. Quote, study finds rate of medication errors resulting in serious medical outcomes rising. And it shows, quote, every 21 seconds, someone in the United States calls poison control because of a medication error. And this was published in Clinical Toxicology. And it talks about how many people are getting sick. How many injuries occur each year in American medicine that could be prevented or should be? Over 10 million. That's a lot of people suffering. Any effort to stop that, change it? No. We're just reporting on it. That's the latest on health and nutrition. I went a little longer than what I wanted to, but now I'm going to play you a short clip. This is a clip from that deals with health, public health issues. Robert Kennedy Jr., the son of Robert Kennedy, the former attorney general and brother of John F. Kennedy and Ted Kennedy, and a major activist, a real people's hero. And he took on the challenge of trying to show what was wrong with just one of the ingredients in vaccines, thimerosal or mercury. Now, he's pro-vaccine, and he vaccinated his own kids, but he's very much opposed to what the science, the real science shows and the toxicological data, is the danger of mercury. So he went to get this message out, and the left, the liberal media, just would not accept that. But there was one. He's the conservative over on Fox, and he had him on. It's a short interview. Please listen in.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has spent years campaigning for safer vaccines in the United States. Recently, that campaign provoked some savage ridicule from HBO host John Oliver. Watch.
These days, very few people will say they are completely anti-vaccine. Instead, like the president, they'll say, I'm not anti-vaccine, but. One example is, hey, I'm not anti-vaccine, but I am pro-safe vaccine. And that can often refer to concern over scary-sounding ingredients like thimerosal, a mercury-based preservative. For years now, RFK Jr. has led a crusade against it. In fact, just this year, he gave a speech where he said this.
For 33 years, I've been working to get mercury out of fish. Nobody has ever called me anti-fish. And because I want mercury out of vaccines, I should not be called anti-vaccine.
Okay, well, for a start, why would anyone be ashamed to be called anti-fish? Fish are stupid. And how do I know that? Look at them. Just look at this idiot.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr. joins us tonight. The response to that piece that John Oliver did really struck me. I think of you as someone whose bona fides as a Democrat and a liberal are kind of unimpeachable, and yet they piled on you. Why? Why is raising questions about the safety of vaccines a no-go zone on the left?
Well, you know, it's interesting because it's not consistent with the traditional liberal posture of skepticism towards large corporate power and particularly the pharmaceutical industry.
Yes.
And government agencies. And CDC has been characterized by at least four federal studies as a cesspool of corruption because of its pervasive interactions, entanglements, I would say, with the vaccine industry. The CDC vaccine branch is really a subsidiary of the vaccine industry. It sells $4.1 billion worth of vaccines a year. It spends about $4.6 billion, almost half of its budget, promoting vaccines, and it only spends $20 million testing vaccines. That's good for a tiny handful of the vaccines we have. One of the problems, and you know, I've been meeting recently with the heads of various federal agencies, and one of the kind of shocking things about vaccines is that there's very little safety testing. If you have a normal drug, let's say Vioxx or Viagra, if you want to bring that to market, typically FDA requires you to do double-blind placebo studies. So you take 9,000 people, give them the pill, 9,000 people, and give them a pill that's identical except it's just sugar. And then you watch typically for around 5 years and see if there's harm.
Yes.
With vaccines, all of those requirements are waived.
I don't know what to think of that. I have many children. I had them all vaccinated. I'm not against vaccines. But I am for asking sincere questions, and I suspect...
Exactly.
I'm deeply suspicious of people who shout down those questions on the basis of the fact they're unfashionable. So I still don't understand why all of a sudden you're not allowed to ask sincere questions. I don't think you're getting paid for this, are you?
No, I'm not. In fact, I'm getting unpaid for this. It's been probably the worst career move that I've ever made. But you know, this is it's deeply concerning to me, because if you look at the vaccine schedule was expanded dramatically in 1989. In 1987, Congress passed a law giving blanket immunity from liability to vaccine manufacturers. So suddenly, vaccines became pay dirt. There was a gold rush to put new vaccines on the schedule. I got 3 vaccines when I was a kid, and I was fully compliant. My children got 69 vaccines. Today's children got 74 vaccines, 74 shots of 16 vaccines. So, and nobody has ever tested what all those vaccines do together. And in fact, many of the vaccines have not been tested at all for the illnesses that are associated with them.
I don't know what the answer is, but I know what the questions ought to be, and you always have a place in the show to ask them. Anyone with sincere questions.
You know, Tucker, that is very kind and courageous of you, because, as you know, most television hosts will not let you on to talk about this issue. On the evening news, typically 17 out of 24 advertisements are pharmaceutical advertisements, and most hosts are frightened of that. So I am very grateful to you for your willingness.
I don't think we ought to be afraid of honest questions, and I think you're asking them. Thank you.
Well, first of all, I thank Tucker Carlson for having the courage to invite him on the air. We have also had Robert F. Kennedy here on our program. In fact, Richard Gale, who's sitting in studio with me right now, will never exclude someone because they're politics. We bring them on because they have something to share. It was an interesting thing that Robert Kennedy said. He was using Viagra and Vioxx. Vioxx killed between 60,000 and 500,000 Americans. And based upon the newest research, I'm tending to agree it's closer to 500,000. They knew in advance, through a Dr. Graham at the FDA, that Vioxx had been shown to increase the likelihood of stroke and heart attacks. They marketed it anyhow. They made about $22 billion. They paid $5 billion in fines. They were able to keep $17 billion. Nobody went to jail. The value of the company went up, and their advertising stayed. They weren't even mandated to take it off the air. Could you imagine that you have advertising that entices people to buy something, you're not forced to take it off the air? You have a product that's killed more Americans than all American casualties in Vietnam, and yet the FDA does not insist that you take it off the shelves. They voluntarily took it off. It was only on for four years. But everything about that one product that he just mentioned shows how bad the science is, and it was not journalists who exposed this. It was a whistleblower, Dr. Graham, who exposed it, and himself for exposing this, because we went to Washington, we interviewed Dr. Graham, and he is in Vaccine Nation, our film. So when he said that he is now losing money, and this was the worst career move he ever made, I can tell you that it's absolutely the same when it comes to AIDS. When I show you the 1,200 people I personally work with who I paid for their therapy, paid the doctors and the nurses and all the bills, and they got well, and they overcame AIDS, and they were alive and well and proven, you would think that people would be interested in that. To the contrary, not when you're dealing with the most profitable medical industry in history, the AIDS industry. So they gathered together. The liberal community would not touch that subject, just like there are a lot of subjects they won't test. Join me in studio as our executive producer, Richard Garrell. Richard, what in the hell is going on with the liberal community? Have they lost their mind or courage, or they're not willing to look at any reality except their own ideological ones?
As we just heard from Robert Kennedy, he was making a reference to the mainstream media, and I don't think anybody would disagree, and we'd have to even agree with Trump and the GOP on this, is that the majority of the mainstream media is liberal. We have in Wall Street, Washington Post, the New York Times, CNN, MSNBC are liberal. Yes, they will sometimes kowtow to certain conservative things to give some kind of a sense of balance, but it is the liberal mainstream. And I've struggled with this because liberalism today is in a complete meltdown. The term is not we can't even hardly define it, because we have you know, those who will march against Wall Street, and they'll march against military industrial bank, but those are also liberals who do that. And then there are those liberals who favor the bailout of the banks and will invest to support regime change and have nothing to say against the Patriot Act. We have those liberals that are socialists. Their whole socialist qualities, you know, universal health care, free college education, increasing the minimum wage. But then there are those liberals still in the same camp who were ardent free market capitalists, privatize everything, including our public schools, support the horrible trade deals and trade partnerships such as NAFTA and discredit the Trans-Pacific and Atlantic partnerships that Obama and the Clintons have supported. I think... here's a definition that separates what we consider the mainstream liberal and what Robert Kennedy is opposing with a self-proclaimed liberal like Jill Stein. I mean, she would call herself a liberal, or a teacher, or Zephyr Teachout and some others. And that is that mainstream liberalism is based on liberal piety. And by that, I mean that the existing system that distributes wealth and power, i.e. capitalism and the American imperialism, are morally defensible. They're morally defensible for the liberals. But we only need to try to make them fair, not dismantle them. Challenging the vaccine paradigm requires more than just making it fair. We are challenging a whole paradigm. If we are looking at getting rid of the military industrial complex with bases all around the world, where we are the world's police chief, that is a dismantling. That is what mainstream liberalism opposes. We can support. So there's no voices against Clinton going into Yugoslavia, Bosnia. There's no voices against Obama and Hillary going into Ukraine, Libya, Honduras, and Paraguay, and then starting with the debacle we have with Syria today. It's more what we have in place is morally defensible. Let's just make it fair. That is the liberal stance, I believe.
Well, that's why we have the Progressive Radio Network.
Yes, we have
Thank you. And right now, in the other room, we are set up to film right after this broadcast one of the most important investigative reporting voices in the world, giving brand new information that no one is aware of, no one's seen, no one's read, that will completely deconstruct the entire vaccines are safe and effective dialogue. We will nail this, and we're nailing it within the next half hour. And this will be on my new documentary, which will be out later this summer. So I want to thank Richard Gilroy, one of our scholars in residence, and our executive producer, for coming in here. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to normally what we would do is each day all the other radio stations around the United States who carry this program would be carrying this live right now. Some get it on delayed feed. But we have sent out a different signal to them today because we're going to take a few minutes to help our sister station, WBAI in New York, because I spoke with the program director. And he said, we really need to get some income in because we can't afford all the premiums. So we're going to help just for maybe 5 minutes, and then we're going to our guest to finish off the show. So please stay with us back in a moment. Dr. Ramzi Baroud, B-I-R-O-U-D, is an Arab U.S. journalist, author, and internationally recognized syndicated columnist and geopolitics expert, especially on Middle East issues. In fact, Eric Wahlberg, who has been on this program, has called Dr. Baroud one of the best emissaries of Palestine. He is currently the editor of the Palestinian Chronicle, and he is also the author of a new book, My Father Was a Freedom Fighter, Gaza's Untold Story, and his website is ramzybaroud.com. www.ti.net. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me, Gary.
You're perhaps best known as being one of the champions of advocating a counter-narrative, an alternative history on the Palestinian crisis, in contrast to the typical one that the American media promotes all the time, the Israeli Zionist narrative that dominates our American mainstream media and politics. And one of the more disconcerting strategies of the Israeli lobbyist propaganda is to eradicate Palestine from the history books. And the Republican Party has largely adopted this strategy unquestionably. And Trump's talk in Israel last May was largely a regurgitation of the Israeli Zionist narrative. So we have not covered some of the updates on conditions in Gaza in a while. And you noted that a UN report in 2015 concluded that Gaza would be uninhabitable by 2020, a mere 3 years from now. It's clearly an open-air prison, even sectioned off into wards. The Israeli government continues to enable settlers to encroach on Palestinian lands. And essential resources to sustain living conditions are rationed. And Israeli further implements policies and actions that increase Palestinians' hardships. And our media is silent about these acts. Nor do we hear of the several hundred-mile wall being built around the Palestinian, technically turning it into a fascist concentration camp, since Gaza doesn't even have access to its own coastland for trade and humanitarian supplies without Israel's supervision. So could you take your time and detail what life is like for the average person living in Gaza, the average Palestinian, and in the context of the UN assessment, what does it mean to state that Gaza will be uninhabitable in the near future? The forum is yours.
Thank you, and thank you for having me at your lovely show. I think it's important to note here that Gaza is part of a larger problem that includes the West Bank and East Jerusalem, two regions that were at one point part of what we call historic Palestine before Israel was established in 1948. And these regions as well suffer from the various restrictions and lack of freedom, arbitrary arrests and constant murder that happens in various parts of the occupied territories. Gaza in particular has been used kind of as a human experiment, collective punishment. This has been going on for about 10 years. Not that Gaza, prior to the Israeli siege 10 years ago, was much better off, but it seems that a terrible situation can, in fact, get more difficult and more inhumane. In 2006, Palestinians throughout the occupied territories elected a new parliament. Even though it's a parliament under occupation, therefore, really not as effective as you would have a parliament under a sovereign government. Nonetheless, it was meant to elect a leadership that represents the Palestinian people, because the current leadership does not. The outcome of that election is that Hamas was elected to power, a decision that was not did not bode well for Israel and other Palestinians, other corrupt Palestinian ruling elites in the West Bank, and of course for the United States. And since then, Gaza has been punished. All sorts of weapons have been used against Gaza. Several wars were unleashed on Gaza in 2008 and 9, in 2012, and the last most destructive war in 2014, where 2,400 people, 80% of them were civilians, along with 5,500 people, were killed and wounded. Nearly 20% of the entire Gaza Strip was destroyed. Over 25,000 homes were destroyed. Thousands of other infrastructures and hospitals and schools and police stations and anything you can think of. And after every major disaster of this nature, any country in the world that would undergo such hardship would immediately resume the process of rebuilding. except in Gaza, of course. Gaza remained under siege, so the homeless people remained homeless as a result of the 2014 war. Many of the schools remained demolished. There is extreme level of poverty and hardship. Nearly 45% of all Gazans are unemployed, is one of the highest rates in the world. But those who are employed, in fact, most of them are still humanitarian aid dependents. They are in need of food rations and such in order for them to survive. So this is the reality of Gaza. Even the farmers are unable to reach their arable land in northern Gaza. Even fishermen are not allowed to fish past 3 or 4 nautical miles into the sea. So that there is every possible attempt at suffocating Gaza. The former advisor to the Israeli government, Dov Weisglass, once said, when the siege was imposed on Gaza, he said that we have no intention of starving Gaza, we just want to put them on a diet. It was basically a diet in which they are not dead, but they are not fully alive, somewhere in the middle, and it's been going on ever since. Sadly, the so-called international community has ignored Gaza. It's been going on for a long time. The Israeli Zionist propaganda has worked so well to the point that, for example, the Israel Times today had an editorial talking about how Hamas is to blame for what is happening in Gaza. There's absolutely no sense of accountability, no punishment of any sort has been imposed on Israel. And as far as the American narrative is concerned, particularly the recent visit by Nikki Haley, the U.S. UN ambassador, she visited the Israeli border of the Gaza Strip, showed sympathy with the Israelis living on the other side of Gaza. For as far as she is concerned, Gazans don't exist, Palestinians don't exist.
Please continue.
So this is the reality that Gaza is going through. But the question in my mind is really more than that of a mere humanitarian question. And I think many of us, oftentimes with goodwill, really think of the question as that of food and medicine, which is extremely essential for Gaza. But it goes beyond that. It's a political question as well. It's a people who are being collectively punished for daring to resist the Israeli occupation, for daring to fight back, for daring to express their political views, for daring to exercise their political rights and to elect their own representatives. Israel does not see that notion of Palestinians being self-assertive and stating their demands. They don't see it favorably. It's been the case since Israel was established in 1948, any attempt at organizing, mobilizing, resisting, whether violently or otherwise, has always been crushed by the Israelis. The type of Palestinian that works very well with the Israeli agenda is the Palestinian who's quisling, the Palestinian who is willing to sign on the dotted line, not the Palestinian who is fighting and resisting and making bold demands. The Palestinian people have not had any freedom for the last 70 years. Palestine was occupied by Israel, and since then, 5 million Palestinians are now refugees all across the world. I come from a refugee family. Vast majority of Palestinians do. Most of us live in diaspora. Some of us are, you know, so-called luckier than others. But you have millions of Palestinians who are living in refugee camps in Lebanon, in Jordan, in Syria. And not that it's a refugee issue that should be assigned to the history books. To the contrary, after the civil war in Syria commenced, Palestinians once more found themselves on the run. Palestinian refugees in Yarmouk and many other refugee camps in Syria itself are now refugees once more somewhere else. There are some Palestinians who are second, third, and fourth time refugees being chased after from one country to the other, from one place to the other. So this is the reality in which Palestinians live through, but it's also the very reality that is accentuated and experienced in the most pronounced and dramatic way in Gaza itself. It really is kind of a representation
Ramzi,
of the greater Palestinian.
Ramzi, I need. We're running out of time, but I want you just to tell us what it's like one day in the average Gazian life. Just real quick, no more politics. Just focus upon this is what touches people's heart, not the politics, not the injustice. I wish it were, but it's not.
Yeah.
But show what a person has to go through in a given day, and then suddenly that reflects when a person thinks, gee whiz, what if I were in that person's shoes, how would I feel? Give us that
day,
please.
Well, you know, here is something that's not based on my personal deduction and assumptions, but rather based on knowledge of a branch of my family that lives in Gaza right now. One of my cousins, her name is Rania. She is she was diagnosed with breast cancer a year ago. There is no cancer treatment in Gaza. So she would have to go to the West Bank, and she had, in order for her to do that, she needs a permit from the Israeli military. The Israeli military is refusing to give her a permit. Therefore, she is living with cancer in Gaza, praying and waiting and going to every possible NGO and to the Red Cross and crying to this and begging that in order for her to get a permit to cross, and the Israeli army would not let her, or hundreds, if not thousands, of people like her with such ailments to actually cross to get that treatment. She's a mother of three children, fairly educated woman, and really not even involved in politics whatsoever, but this is the reality of it. Others, they would have to go to feeding centers, UNRWA, United Nations centers in various parts of Gaza in order for them to line up for food. In many parts of Gaza, there is no clean water. People would have to take whatever they can carry water in, and they would go and line up in order for them to get water. Electricity is now down to 2 to 3 hours a day. It doesn't come at fixed hours, so you never know. It could be there at 1 in the morning. It could be there in the afternoon. But the moment that the electricity is back in Gaza for these 2 to 3 hours, everybody rushes to do whatever they can, to charge their phones, to charge their computers, to do their homework, to do their laundry, to do whatever, until it turns off and they are back to just the process of waiting and praying. This has been going on for all of those years. Now, this is not to mention anything about the, according to the UN, 35,000 people are still homeless in Gaza, 35,000 people who are living in tents in Gaza. And again, there is no process of building. Only 20% of everything that has been destroyed in Gaza in 2014 has been more or less rebuilt. The rest is not. There is no cement. Everything used to come from underneath tunnels connecting Gaza to Egypt. Now the tunnels have been destroyed by the Egyptians. So even that lifeline of hope has been shut down. So this is the reality of it, and one can go on and on and on, but this is what it is without this is the reality that applies almost to everybody in the Gaza Strip. But some people's situations are far worse and more complex than that.
Ramzi, I appreciate you coming on, bringing us this. I believe that what would help the cause towards peace, because I believe that Israelis deserve to live in peace without fear, and I believe Palestinians deserve to live in peace without fear. And it's entirely possible to rebuild the Palestinian territories so that you could bring in businesses, people could be gainfully employed, you could get a quality of life, you can get healthy water, all the things that anyone would expect can happen. It is the politics that keeps it from happening. So maybe at some point someone would do a documentary, not politics. Don't even bring in any politics. Simply take a documentary and show what it's like in one day, 24 hours, in the life of an average Palestinian. Someone not associated with Hamas, not associated with any terrorist group, just someone just trying to live their life. That would have far more impact than 100 politically motivated documentaries. Just a suggestion. I want to thank you for being on, Ramzi Baroud, B-A-R-O-U-D, and hopefully people will read your book, My Father Was a Freedom Fighter, Gaza's Untold Story, or go to your website, ramzibaroud.net. Thanks for being there. I'm Gary Knoll. We want to see peace in the world. We want to see everyone be able to live an ethical, happy, decent, healthy life. Have a nice day, everyone.